Good morning. Welcome to the press briefing of the UN Information Service in Geneva. Today is Friday, 17th of January already. Incredible. I would like to start with an announcement on the travel of the Secretary General to Lebanon. The Secretary General arrived in Beirut, Lebanon, yesterday. Upon arrival, he was met by the caretaker, Foreign Minister of Lebanon, Dr. Abdullah Bou Habib. Today, as we speak, the Secretary General is in Nakoura, in southern Lebanon, to visit UNIFIL to express his gratitude for the courage and determination of the UN peacekeepers who have been working in very challenging circumstances. During his time on the ground, the Secretary General visited a number of positions in UNIFIL that had been hit by Israeli forces last year. Before leaving UNIFIL, the Secretary General will address the mission's leadership, and we will share with you those remarks. We'll make them public. This evening, upon his return to Beirut, the Secretary General, along with the UN Special Coordinator in Lebanon, Janine Hennis-Plasschaert, and the UNIFIL Force Commander, General Haroldo Lazaro, is expected to attend a working dinner hosted by the caretaker Prime Minister of Lebanon, Najib Mikati. Saturday, the Secretary General is expected to spend the day in Beirut, where he will meet with President Joseph Aoun, Prime Minister designated Nawaf Salam, and the Speaker of the Parliament, Nabi Berri. We expect the Secretary General to hold a press conference late Saturday afternoon. He will return back to New York on Sunday and be at the Security Council meeting on the Middle East on Monday. So this is what I could say of the trip of the Secretary General to Lebanon. Was that a question? No? Was a hand up? Okay. So that is for the announcement of the trip of the SG. I also have an announcement from the UN Human Rights Council, who asks me to tell you that 14 states will have their human rights records examined during the 48th session of the Human Rights Council Universal Periodic Review Working Group, which starts on Monday. The 48th session of the UPR Working Group will be held in room 20 from 31st January 2025. The 14 states to be reviewed by the UPR working group during this session are, in order of scheduled review, Italy, El Salvador, The Gambia, Bolivia, Fiji, San Marino, Kazakhstan, Angola, Iran, Madagascar, Iraq, Slovenia, Egypt, and Bosnia and Herzegovina. Details of this 48th session and the countries to be reviewed are on the Human Rights Council website and on the press release that was shared with you last Wednesday. And with this announcement, I'd like to now go to our first topic. We should have online, yes, I can see him, Rick Peppercorn. Welcome, Rick. You are calling in from Jerusalem for WHO. I think Tariq is also online. Let me see if it's the case. I don't know, Tariq, if you want to start, can I give the floor immediately to Rick? And we will listen from him and update on the health situation in OPT. There's an echo here.
And we could go straight to Dr. Peppercorn.
Okay, thank you very much. Thank you very much. Rick, you are on. Thank you.
Can you, good morning, and I hope you're all doing fine. Can you hear me loud and clear?
We can.
Okay, good. Thank you very much, because we had some problems, some technical problems. So first of all, greetings from Jerusalem. I want to raise a few topics with regard to Gaza, but also a number of comments on the West Bank. But first, let's start with the ceasefire, the imminent ceasefire, I should say. It's for us, and I think for probably all of us, the best news since long times. WHO, we welcome the announcement of a deal to secure a ceasefire and hostage release in Gaza. And we, of course, hope that all parties will respect their commitment to fully implement the deal, quickly go through those three phases and work towards this so much needed lasting peace. WHO and partners, we stand ready to support the health system and the people of Gaza, in specifically now planning to scale up its operations, mobilizing critical supplies and resources to address the immediate needs and support early recovery efforts. It's of course critical that the significant security and political obstacles to delivering aid across Gaza are removed. We need a rapid, unhindered and safe access and expedited flow of aid into and across to Gaza. I want to also really mention that when people talk about restoring a health system, that it is very much a collective effort and must and will be guided and executed in close collaboration with the Ministry of Health. We finally need Palestinian solutions for everything, including for health and the health sector. The Ministry of Health, the health workforce, specifically when you talk about Gaza, in Gaza, the partners, WHO partners, and the international community. And we also really urge donors and the global community to provide this flexible funding so much needed to enable a swift and effective responses to the urgent, specifically now, I want to say, to the longer term needs. We've heard it all along. The UN and partners are very much ready. They cannot do that alone on all fronts. Private sector is critical. Private supply chain should be restored and basic commodities allowed to flood Gaza. Now, when you look at WHO support specifically, and WHO leading and coordinating part of the health cluster, the health partners, together with the cluster partners, a 60-day implementation plan for ceasefire was already prepared in the past, but I think, of course, it has been updated. And for us, in line with the health ceasefire plan, we also have our own plan as part of that. So the plan will initially, because we have to be pragmatic, and initially the humanitarian support in all areas, if you talk about food security and water and non-food items, also specifically in health, will need to continue and need to be expanded. And further in the next phases of the ceasefire. So our efforts will focus to continue to restore, but especially expand essential health services. And we have orders and in coordination with partners and the Ministry of Health, we have ordered temporary prefabricated clinics, prefab clinics and hospitals, which we will integrate into the existing facilities, but not stand alone. Integrate an existing health facility as part of that to expand some needed bed capacity, address urgent health needs, and health service delivery if in underserved and newly accessible area. So the focus will be on the 7 priority response. Trauma and emergency care will continue. Restoring and expanding comprehensive primary health care is probably the most important. And then have a focus on child health, sexual reproductive health and rights, non-communicable diseases, multidisciplinary rehabilitation, mental health, and psychosocial support. Expansions of the services will require strengthening of a delivery of service capacity. So expanding not only and making sure that the Gaza health workers can do their work. A lot of them are doing it in an incredibly resilient way, but a lot of them are there in these makeshift shelters, etc. They should go back to in their original jobs, including which are already there, emergency medical teams, and we want to get more specialized care teams as well to scaling up the service which are really needed. Scaling of supply chains via all possible routes, and you've seen other news on that, ensure adequate delivery of stocks and essential medicines and supplies. Now, the hospitals, if you take some examples of that, and for me, coming into Gaza every 2 months for a number of weeks, you look, for example, at in Gaza City to Al-Shifa, Al-Ahli, and Al-Tisi, Al-Sahaba, patient-friendly. We're all in Ashifa, we want to increase the bed capacity to adding 200 beds. Pediatric inpatients capacity in Al-Rantisi of another 50-bed, increased the hemodialysis machines to over 30 units. In North Gaza, expansion also served Al-Ada and restoration of service in Kamalat 1 in Indonesia. Special, and I would say the special comprehensive teams to make sure that they can go to deploy them to Shifa, Al-Ahli, Rantisi, etc., and Kamalat 1 and the others. As well, looking at the south, to do the same in the south, make sure that you get these special care teams, EMTs already there, to Nasser, European Gaza, Al-Aqsa as well. Now, restoring the health infrastructure, there is too much to actually to start there. But I think we have to focus at the basics first, and that's, of course, electricity, the utilities, water, electricity, waste management systems. Addressing malnutrition is an ongoing effort, and the protection of communities from epidemics, the whole public health intelligence. We struggle with that, with surveillance systems, Ministry of Health and partners. How can we make sure that we reactivating EORs, etc., to report outbreak management, etc.? Stabilize the strength of human resources, and I think it's probably the most critical, ensure that all Gaza health workers can do their job, and deploying additional healthcare professionals, including external medical teams and local works to fill critical gaps. Preparedness and public health projection, and last but not least, of course, governance and coordination as well. On medevac, this is something where we hope in this ceasefire, even in the ceasefire processes, the three phases, we should, of course, be transferring to a sustained peace process. But even in the initial phases, we hope to expand on medevac over the coming months. As we all know, the medical evacuation remains incredibly slow. So before the Rafah crossing was closed, we talked about 4,700 patients. Mm-hmm. And then from 6 May, only 418 patients now have been medevac, all with assistance of WHO. Now, we estimate that at least 12,000 patients need actually the special care and treatments at other places than Gaza. So if you continue like that, we are busy for the next 5 to 10 years. Now, with this ceasefire agreement, we want to see that the traditional referral pathway to East Jerusalem and the West Bank opens up, but also, of course, pathways to Egypt, hopefully through the Rafah crossing, can be expanded, etc., and through and to Jordan, and from there to others. Just, I think it's good to say that if you look at the number of patients from requests submitted between 27 November and 24 December 2024, only 29 patients of 1,200 patients were approved for medical evacuation abroad. So the stumbling block is actually the approval process as one of the main. And of these 1,200 patients, 405 are children, and only 10 were approved to travel with companions. This needs to change. So 99 were approved for travel without companions, which means they cannot leave. Children have to travel with their companions. And 148 children were denied, and 148 are pending approval. The 148 children who were denied will be reconsidered by the Israeli authorities for medical evacuation abroad. We hope now with the ceasefire, starting coming Sunday, the ceasefire process, that this will be all better facilitated and supported.
Thank you. Sorry.
Quick, can I make just one, say two words on the West Bank? So the focus on the West Bank, because we forget that all the time, the access to health, operations, increasing settler violence, continued closure of checkpoints, arbitrary obstructions, detention of health workers, as well the closure of entire towns and communities are impeding access. So 52 out of the 52 hospitals are at least partially functioning, 22 are partly accessible, and 3 primary causes of functionality constraint as reported by 8 partially functioning hospitals, lack of staff, equipment and supplies. and the three primary causes for accessibility constraints as reported by 22 partially accessible hospitals: insecurity, financial barriers such as user fees, and other physical barriers. Over to you.
Thank you very much, Rick, for this update. It's really important to speak about this ahead of the what's going to happen on Saturday. But I just would like to first tell our journalists that we have online James Elder. He can answer a question on the situation of children in Gaza, but he needs to leave in 5 minutes, and maybe he will manage to join afterwards. But if there is any specific question for James on the situation of children, can you please raise your hand now so that I can, yeah? Maya, for James. And then, of course, you'll also be ready to give questions to Rick. Please. James, that's for you.
Yes, regarding the numbers, thank you very much for taking my question, Alexander. James, if you could please give us the numbers of children that have been now in a state of injured and compared to the number of dead, if you do have that number, or if you could give us at least an overview of what the situation as far as children that need urgent needed to be urgently hospitalized.
James.
Yeah, look, the numbers game is perilous. I think it's worth everyone looking at the report that came out last Friday from, you know, one of the world's oldest and most prestigious medical journals, the peer-reviewed report in The Lancet that actually pointed to numbers in excess of what the Ministry of Health had been reporting. That's very, very important because, of course, we have been standing by our use of those Ministry of Health numbers of children that already show upwards of 15,000 girls and boys having been killed. That's around 35 a day, 35 children killed reportedly every single day for 14 months. The Lancet's peer-reviewed report actually points to more children. So that simply underlines what Rick has spoken to, why this moment is just so absolutely critical and so overdue. There's been around 10 children killed every single day this year. So there are so many reasons why this deal needed to happen much earlier, but why we now need phase one, phase two, and so critically, phase three to take place. At the same time, we are seeing deaths from hypothermia, which speaks to a lack of the ability to get aid supplies into the Gaza Strip. October, November, December, the last 3 months of last year were the lowest cumulative of a three-month period since the horrors of the 7th of October. So we've seen children die of malnutrition. We've seen children die of hypothermia. We've seen children die, as we have warned for a long, long time, from the skies and from the ground. So, you know, I wholeheartedly support everything Rick said, including those very impressive scale-up plans you hear, because people are absolutely at rock bottom, and they have been for a long time. I spoke to a lot of people in Gaza yesterday and heard very similar refrain from them, which is they are so glad the kill, quote unquote, the killing will stop, but they live in a tent now and they'll go back and they'll live in a tent above their rubble. Or, you know, what does it mean? Because we have nothing left. We have to now ensure that it does mean something. And that means those authorities, those signatories to this agreement, ensure an enabling environment for getting aid across the Gaza Strip, all those things Rick spoke to, which is something that has been lethally absent in the past year and 2 months.
James, sorry, I know you have to go in 2 minutes, but Gabriella has a question for you.
Yes, thank you, Alessandra. James, we just heard that 12,000 people are wounded or sick, and they need treatment in another parts. So do you have an estimate how many of them are children? Thank you.
It's a great question, and it's something we've worked on. Look, WHO lead on this, and WHO have been incredible. And Rick just mentioned some of those numbers there, and he might repeat some of those. It's a critical element. You'll remember, and I will, Gabriella, I can reshare the press briefing we did 2 months ago that showed a 90% plus reduction in medical evacuations of children into the 6 months since the Rafah crossing closed. And when I was listening to Rick there, it sounded like the numbers had got even more dire. Now, remembering this is not a logistical problem, this is simply a problem of intent. So it was a very important element that he added. So I would defer to Rick, but I can reshare those numbers from a month or so ago. go. And I too want to reiterate the numbers that I just heard from Rick, because they do point to medical evacuations, despite the public advocacy, despite the private advocacy, has not been improving for thousands of children who somehow survived the bombardment, the missiles, the quadcopters, and then died of their injuries, excruciatingly painful injuries in hospitals. And this is not past tense. Those children sit in hospitals as we speak. So I'm sorry not to have greater clarity on numbers, but I know Rick does.
Thank you very much, James. I know you have a hard stop here, but Rick has already raised his hand. And Rick, I've got lots of questions for you. So let's go back to you. Thanks, James. If you can connect again later, that would be great. Okay, so let me start. Okay, Rick, you want to maybe complete what James said, and then we'll go to other questions. Go ahead.
Yeah, I would like to add something on what James said. I hope James is still online. So first, I think James made a really important point. So we look, of course, at the figures. We always talk about the number of people killed in Gaza, like 46,000, 47,000, and the number of people injured, close to 110,000. Now, we also saw the study from in the Lancet by the London School and Yale, which actually comes that the number of people being killed is an underestimate. It's probably closer to 70,000. We always raise that, actually, in all of it. Secondly, we don't even talk about what we call the indirect death. So people who had all kinds of chronic diseases, etc., couldn't access the treatments they needed and died over the last 15 months. That runs in the tens of thousands. That's the estimate. So the number of deaths is actually much direct, indirect is much higher than what's actually projected. And then from the 110,000 injured, and we've raised it, there's this WHO assessment together with the EMTs, Ministry of Health, that estimated one quarter of that, so that is now more than 25, almost 30,000 patients, will need lifelong rehabilitation and assisted technology. So this is putting some numbers. And then about the number of children, the question like how many children from those 12,000, you know, would be, what do we estimate how many children? I can just say that when we look at the last figures, I mentioned that the request submitted between late November and late December, 1,200 patients, more than a quarter, 4 in 5 of them were children. So I would expect that roughly one third of them are and will be children. And if you look at the number of people killed, which is currently used, this figure 46,000, 47,000, roughly almost one third of them are children. 14,555. That's the latest figures we have. Over to you for the other questions.
Thank you very much. Okay, so let me start with the questions here in the room. Aysu Beyza first, Anna Dulwanzi.
Good morning, Alessandra. Thank you. And good morning, Mr. Pepcorn. I would like to ask, since the ceasefire deal agreement announced, is there any change in the 8 trucks that WHO can get into Gaza? Or are there still restrictions going on that? And also, I want to ask, you said WHO is planning to increase the operations once the ceasefire is take effect. Do you have targeted volume of aid get inside of Gaza in the first few days of the ceasefire? Thank you.
Rick?
Very much. So this, of course, it's not just WHO. First of all, the ceasefire process starts on Sunday, and the UN and partners are very much planning to prioritize as much as possible. You've seen in the documents the targets to get between 500 and 600 trucks in per day over the coming weeks during those phases. That would be a huge increase of the 40 to 50 what we have seen over the last months. So it would be an enormous increase. Now, with it's not just WHO, with the health parts, the cluster plan is there. Yeah, we will try to do our level best to, of course, get the priority items in as quickly as possible. And hopefully it will, of course, depend if it really works out. And I'm hopeful for that. We have to be hopeful that those routes will be expanded to bring the goods in, both in the north and the south of Gaza. So an expansion, it will be an unhindered and safe access of an expanded flow of aid. There's, of course, concerns also about security within Gaza, which has to be addressed, which I also already raised. And it is the UN and I think everyone negotiating that ceasefire is focusing on those priorities. So yeah, let's say hopes that this will definitely expand the flow of aid in general, and with the focus, of course, on the key priorities. Food will be one, water will be one, non-food item will be one, and including medical supplies. We also, as I said, we hope to get in there more difficult supplies. There's a lot of issues. For example, fuel is one area, but there's also, and if you talk to hospital directors, they all run on their generators. There's some silly things. There's a huge need in generator repair parts and spare parts, in generator oil, which we haven't been able to bring in. So all that kind of, even if you go to NASA Medical Complex, and I was there 6 weeks ago, again, the director said, one item they also miss is paper, just A4 paper to make sure that, you know, they're because they don't have an electronic patient system to follow their systems. So all, there are so many needs which can be addressed. They're being prioritized right now. They were prioritized, and hopefully it will be. I think that we should be careful raising too many expectations, and the focus initially should be as pragmatic as possible, expand the humanitarian assistance as much as possible. And in the meantime, work on for health, work on restorations of this basic electricity, water systems, waste management, etc.
Thank you, Rick. I've got 10 questions for you and many more speakers afterwards. If you could answer a little bit briefly the questions. I'll go to Nina Larsson, AFP.
Yeah, thank you for taking my question. Hi, Rick. I just wanted to follow up on the press briefing given by WHO yesterday when you mentioned the amounts that your the initial assessments are for the needs for rebuilding Gaza. And you mentioned in the first 1.5 years, $3 billion, and then it was either 5 to 7 or 6 to 7 years, it was $10 billion. We wanted to clarify if that was if that should be added to each other, if it was combined, if it was 3 plus 10, or if it was 10 combined within the 7 years. Thank you.
Yeah. So what I said, so maybe I was unclear. So all these processes are in place with government, World Bank, EU, UN, and partners to make those analysis overall, and also specific per sector. So WHO, of course, we work closely with as part on health. And the initial type of assessment on health is that to restore the overall health system in Gaza, yeah, it would run into 10 billion plus, actually. That is the overall figure. I think, however, we have to be pragmatic. And as I said, when we are now getting into a ceasefire process and three phases, which should be continuing into a sustained peace process and hopefully a long-lasting solution. So initially, we really have to focus when it comes to health, to this expanding of this humanitarian support and the areas I mentioned previously. Over to you.
Thank you very much. Oui, vas-y. Jeremy Lange, Radio France Internationale.
Thank you. Just want to follow up on the previous question. When we talk about aid coming up and in Gaza, ceasefire, if it happens, it's in 2 days. So if we're going to go from 40 trucks to 500, 600 trucks a day, does it mean that technically you have trucks right now going to the frontier, queuing in front of Gaza? Is it what's happening now? Like trucks are actually, coming up to Gaza and queuing?
Well, we all know that, of course, this is not WHO. So, I mean, this question should be not be addressed, maybe should be addressed to the humanitarian coordinator and team. But of course, we know there are thousands of trucks in Egypt, for example, and at the Jordan sites, but also other routes would open up through Ashdod, and restoring a route from the West Bank and East Jerusalem into Gaza. So if it is possible straight away to go to 600, I don't know, we'll see. I think if the political will is there and a lot of impediments are taken out and routes are opening up, and that is all in the plan, that there will be many entrances added into Gaza, then I think that should be possible. That is the health part, and the WHO part is just a very small part of that. Over to you.
Thank you very much. I saw a hand there, Gurila von Hall, Svenska Dagenblad.
Yeah, it's a question along these lines too. You know, what are your plans concretely if the ceasefire holds on Sunday? You're planning to start going in on Monday. You talked about challenges, security. Could you be a bit more specific? What do you think are going to be the largest logistic and security challenges for delivering aid? Thanks.
Well, first of all, I think you heard that there was this huge struggle to increase the number of supplies getting into Gaza and across Gaza, including from the south to the north or from the north to the south, etc. So that is, of course, remains the biggest challenge. That is going to be taken away when the ceasefire starts. That is part of the ceasefire arrangements, etc. That's not WHO. That's the parties who concluded this deal and the UN in general. So if those obstructions are taken away and we will have more entrances into Gaza, and indeed there are many trucks already ready, I mean, again, I say no one will know if straight away will be 600, but I think the possibility is very much there that this can be built up very rapidly. And specifically when other crossings will be opened, like Rafah, through Jordan, a number of additional crossings in the north and in the south, that should be possible. The security issues within Gaza and of course the transport within Gaza, that needs to be addressed and solved, but also on that part, work is going on. Over to you.
Thank you very much. Beza, there are so many questions. Let me go to somebody who has not spoken. It's really urgent. Okay, quickly. Thank you. Beza again.
Sorry for that. I think Mr. Pipico missed my first question. I asked, since the ceasefire deal announced, is there any change in the aid flow, WHO missions, or still the same? Thank you.
Well, I think it's been reasonably, that's still at the moment the same. So that WHO, and I think many of you, and we work as one UN, and there's a flash appeal from the one UN. Then there are clusters, WHO leading and coordinating the health cluster. And within that, we of course have our own operational response plan, and we're finalizing the one for 2025. We just completed the one for 2024, including the report. And yes, I think lots, I mean, like I mentioned one figure, but lots of more flexible funding will be needed to expedite that. Every UN agency still have supplies, et cetera, stuck in Egypt or in Jordan, et cetera, which should come in over the coming months. Currently, the aid moving into Gaza has been slow. We all know that. So that should definitely change over the coming months. But one thing, which I think I mentioned, that what will be absolutely needed, and there will be many appeals to member states and partners, that there is a global community to provide this flexible funding and to work enabling swift and effective responses. And initially, it will be a continuation of the work we are currently doing. The the component of early recovery, rehabilitation, and hopefully reconstruction should be rapidly expanded. Over to you.
Thank you. Jamie Keaton, Associated Press.
Thank you, Alessandra. Thank you, Dr. Peeplecorn. I'm going to just follow up on what everyone else has been saying, but I just wanted to add a little bit of a different question. How devastating would it be for both aid operations and for public morale if the Israeli government does not go forward and approve the ceasefire, which has prompted such joy as we've seen in Gaza?
Yeah, well, I think you can answer that yourself. I think our assumption is that this is going to continue. And that's my assumption is as well that we're going through the three phases and there will be work, and it is collective responsibility, including from Israel, that we work through to a sustained peace process and a solution. And so, yeah. I think it would be cause utterly devastating if this is not going to happen now. But I think the whole world we all hope and expect that this has happened. I mean, this crisis we can't be solved with solving the protracted crisis. So we have to focus on all of that and look forward. And as well, it's collective responsibility from member states, donors, partners, including Israel, to make sure that there will be an early recovery process, there will be rehabilitation, and there will be reconstruction in Gaza. And it should be Palestinian. It should be Palestinian-led. It should be Palestinian solution for that, with assistance from all of us. Over to you.
Satoko Adachi, Yomiuri Shimbun.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yeah, go ahead, Satoko.
Okay, thank you very much for doing this. Dr. Peeplecorn, you talk about a little bit about fuel, but could you talk about the dual-use items into Gaza? Does the ceasefire deal include loosening restriction to deliver dual-use medical items? And secondly, if a ceasefire happened, then what concerns you have most in terms of implementation of phase one of the ceasefire deal? Thank you.
You mentioned the item for dual use. So it's all, I think, part of the arrangement that a lot of those supplies and equipment will be rapidly approved. The proof will be in the pudding. I mean, like, we will see over the coming months how good this will work. We know that we have had problems also before the crisis with getting some supplies and goods in. For health, I mean, let me focus on health. Before this crisis, it was incredibly difficult to get medical imaging machinery into Gaza, and I talk about mobile X-rays or CTs or MRIs or spare parts for that. Well, there's hardly any MRI left in Gaza at the moment. I think there's one in the north and one in the south. There's a lot of the medical imaging equipment will need to be included over the coming months and years to get into Gaza. Proof will be in pudding that we will put everything like that on the list. And the assumption is, of course, that it is going to work. It's part of a recovery and rehabilitation process. And now I'm only talking about health. If to ask my colleagues on other sectors as well. So yeah, it's part, as far as we understand, it's all part of this arrangement, and we are already submitting that. This I mentioned also, for example, the prefab hospitals. That's also, it would be very difficult in the past to get it in. Now, we're going to push all of that. And the only thing, of course, what I would hope that we will be able to get those goods in. It will take time. If there's obstructions, we will report on it. Over to you.
Thank you very much, Rick. And I go to Nika Mimbrus, New York Times.
Yeah, Rick, I hope you can hear me now. You talked yesterday about the need to, or the wish to bring in prefab hospital units to support the sort of recovery of treatment. Could you just elaborate a little bit on that? How quickly do you think that is something you're going to do? Do you have prefab hospitals already in stock and ready to go? Which are the hospitals where you would prioritize deploying these kind of prefab units? Thank you.
Yeah, this is not easy because I think we have already made assessments of some of the prefab hospitals, of course, in close coordination with the ministry and partners in Gaza, what and how. So our contracts are ready. Before they can come in, I would say we probably need 6 weeks to 2 months to get them in. And I want to stress that point, that what we want to avoid, because we want to avoid that we again bring in separate hospitals, except no, they will be linked as much as possible to the existing system, strengthening the existing system, expanding the capacity there, and very much expanding the bed capacity, but also the land capacity, etc. And that's also what we want to, if this is the time to look to, if there's a need, and there is a need to bring in more specialized emergency medical teams into Gaza, working with the Gaza health workforce as much as possible within the existing health infrastructure. On the longer term, of course, the government WHO partners, we have to look at the whole of the Gaza health system. You know the figures from the 36 hospitals, half, 18 are partly functional. From the primary healthcare clinics, roughly one third are partly functional. But it's also, of course, an opportunity to look at what are the priorities? Primary healthcare is definitely a priority. So where should primary healthcare be delivered? And if that is currently in different places, we have to go, of course, as much as possible where the community are and where they live. That also applies for hospitals. Can we make some changes to maybe which will lead to a more cost-effective health system with a prime focus on primary healthcare? Over to you.
Gabriela Sotomayor, Processo.
Thank you, Alessandra. So you mentioned that 12,000 people, around 12,000 people need special care out of Gaza. When are they going to be evacuated? I don't know how to ask, but how urgent is urgent?
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Thank you very much. Good question. So it's incredibly urgent for those patients because they cannot get the treatment they need and deserve in Gaza. So that's what we and I just want to make the point that before the Rafah crossing was closed in 6 May 2024, before the crossing was closed, and I think it was Ministry of Health partners, WHO, it was quite a number, almost 4,700 patients were medevaced, mainly to Egypt and in the region, from Egypt to the region. But since the crossing was closed and only very small groups of patients go through Kerem Shalom, we talked about these 480 patients, all of them facilitated, supported the whole medevac process through WHO. You probably heard about most of them after that went to the UAE, but also in the other regions and to some European countries as well. Now, if we look at that pace from May till now, only 480 patients, where 12,000 patients need to be medevaced, that this is way, way too slow. And we estimate one third is probably children. We estimate from this 12,000, probably half that is related to the war, trauma cases, if it is severe burns or spinal injuries, amputations, needed additional operations, and etc. But the other half is also a lot of oncology patients who need specific treatment. So that's why we hope and expect that with this ceasefire agreement and over the three phases and leading to a peace, more sustained peace, that Medevac is one area where we can quickly expand through Rafah into Egypt, but also, and we mentioned again and again and again, to restore the traditional referral pathway to East Jerusalem and West Bank. Because before this crisis, between 50 to 100 patients per day were referred from Gaza to East Jerusalem and West Bank. And almost half of those patients before the crisis was related to oncology, to cancer. So we want to restore that, etc. So yeah, very urgent. And I think a ceasefire process and leading to peace is the opportunity to expand on that.
John Zarokostas, Frans van Katren, The Lancet.
Yes, good morning, Rick. Thank you for this. Coming back to what you said earlier, you said it's a collective responsibility, including from Israel. In your talks with the Israeli authorities, what commitments are you getting from the Israeli authorities? And I'm interested in particular, will they be waiving any import duties on the supplies coming in, whether it's the prefab hospitals, et cetera? And secondly, if you have any information on the health personnel in Gaza, how many have left, whether it's medical practitioners or nurses or midwives or technical staff? Thank you.
Yeah, starting with your last question, it's a difficult one. I mean, we estimated before there was roughly between close to 25,000 health workers in Gaza. And I think estimation at least 3,000 or something like that have left. And unfortunately, also a lot of the senior medical staff, a lot of, let's say, the senior specialists. That's why one of the reasons is because a lot of supplies are not there, but also a lot of the top medical specialists, a number of them are not anymore in Gaza. So that is a real issue. So you also, by the way, and we don't even discuss it yet, but with a ceasefire process, that you want the Gazans who have left Gaza and would like to come back, you want to see them back in Gaza to assist in building up Gaza again, because those health workers are the best. They were trained, they know the situation, and yeah, finally, it's all about the local health workforce, which we have to focus on. EMTs and special medical teams can only do so much. So it's a real issue. On the assistance from, my point was, I think, more on the longer term, on when you talk about early recovery and rehabilitation and reconstruction, which will take, as we know, years and years and years and years. That's what I mean, is a collective responsibility and globally, etc. And it should, and also with the support from Israel, they're also responsible there to assist and facilitate that. And it's a global responsibility, global community responsibility. And that should be, of course, always a Palestinian solution, Palestinian plan, which we all jointly support as focused as possible. Now, that will take a long time. The humanitarian support will be needed for years to come, including in health. I want to make that point. On the supplies, the specific supplies that you questioned, yeah, we get signals that this will be better facilitated. Now, again, the proof will be in the pudding, and we will let you know how this is working out. Over to you.
Indeed, and just to complete your answer, Rick, just to inform the journalist, the Sigrid Kaag was earlier this week in Tel Aviv, Jerusalem, and Ramallah, trying to coordinate indeed this preparations for the next days, and also Mohanad Hadi, our deputy special coordinator for the Middle East peace process, has been discussing the same issue in Cairo. So We are preparing, but as we have heard several times this morning, we will only be able to deliver as much as the conditions on the ground will allow. So the Secretary General has been calling for this repetitively in the last hours and days. Thank you very much, Rick. This was extremely useful. I would like really to thank you and brace yourself for all these days coming. There will be, yes, as you said, a lot to do, but the UN are really committed to stay there and supports the implementation of the deal and scale up the delivery of sustained humanitarian relief as much as possible. Thank you so much. Let's now go.
I will plan to go back to Gaza again in a week time, etc. Maybe we can have a report from Gaza.
Absolutely, thank you very absolutely. Much. That would be extremely welcome. So thank you very, very much. Let's change conflict and go to Africa for an update on Sudan and also the situation in South Sudan. So I've got Ravina with me for OHCHR, and we also have Florence Gillette online. Florence is the head of the delegation of the ICRC in South Sudan, and we're going to hear about the conflict in this area. So maybe we start with Ravine, and then I'll go to Florence, and then we will open the floor to questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Alessandra, and good morning, everyone. As Alessandra said, moving from one conflict to another, one extremely dire, catastrophic situation to another. The UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Volker Türk, warns that the conflict in Sudan is taking an even more dangerous turn for civilians after reports that dozens were brutally killed in ethnically targeted attacks in the southeastern state of Al Jazeera and amid reports of an imminent battle for the control of Khartoum. As the Sudanese armed forces and the rapid support forces battle for control at all costs in this senseless war that has raged for close to 2 years now, direct and ethnically motivated attacks on civilians are becoming increasingly common. The situation for civilians in Sudan is already desperate, and there is evidence of the commission of war crimes and other atrocity crimes. We fear the situation is now taking a further, even more dangerous turn. In the last week alone, our office has documented at least 21 deaths in just two attacks in Al Jazeera state, although the actual number of attacks directed against civilians and the number of civilians killed are very likely higher. In an attack on the 10th of January, at least 8 civilians were killed in Taiba camp, and at least 13 women and one man abducted. Houses were burned, livestock, crops, and other property looted, and dozens of families were displaced. The next day, at least 13 civilians were killed, including two boys, in an attack on Kambo Kamza camp. Both camps are located about 40 kilometers from Wad Madani, in the capital of Al Jazeera. Reports suggest that the attacks were carried out by the Sudan Shield Forces, led by Abu Akla Kikal, a former Rapid Support Forces commander who in October last year defected to the SAF. And that they targeted the Kanabi, a historically marginalized group composed mainly of Nuba and other African tribes. We note the Sudanese authorities' assurances that these attacks, which came in the context of the recapture of Wad Madani by the SAF, would be fully investigated and those responsible brought to justice, and that an investigation committee has been established. Retaliatory attacks of shocking brutality on entire communities based on real or perceived ethnic identity are on the rise, as is hate speech and incitement to violence. This must urgently be brought to an end. In 3 videos received by our office that document scenes of violence, including unlawful killings, victims were dehumanized and denigrated and called dirt, mold, animal, and bastards, as they were subjected to violence. Summary executions were hailed by perpetrators as a cleaning operation. The videos were reportedly filmed in Wad Madani with men in SAF uniforms visibly present. Serious concerns also persist for civilians in North Darfur, where ethnically motivated attacks by RSF and its allied Arab militias against African ethnic groups, particularly the Zagawa and the Fur, continue to exact a horrific toll. Separately, in the city of Omdurman, some 120 civilians were reportedly killed and more than 150 injured in drone attacks on the 13th of January, allegedly launched by the SAF on a market in the Ombada Dar es Salaam Square, an RSF-controlled area. We once again call on the President of the Transitional Sovereign Council and the Commander of the Rapid Support Forces to put an end to the fighting. We call on both parties to uphold obligations under international humanitarian law and international human rights law. The proliferation of militia recruitment and mobilization of fighters, largely along ethnic lines, risks unleashing a broader civil war and intercommunal violence. The SAF and the RSF are responsible for the actions of groups and individuals fighting on their behalf. Let us be clear about that. The SAF and RSF must take immediate measures to ensure the protection of all civilians, including by taking all feasible measures to avoid or at the very least minimize harm to civilians in the conduct of hostilities. Attacks must never be directed against civilians. Prompt, independent, impartial, and transparent investigations into all reports of violations and abuses are crucial.
Thank you very much, Ravina, for this. I'll give the floor to Florence now. Welcome.
Thank you very much. So I'm coming to you today from Juba to share what I witnessed last week during your visit to Reng County, including Jodar border crossing in the north of South Sudan a few days ago, and why I found the situation critical there. Reng is town is only a few kilometers from the Sudanese border, and many of its villages are right on the border, across from the states of Blue Nile, White Nile, and Sennar, where fighting inside Sudan has been particularly intense recently. During the recent hostilities and airstrikes, more than 120,000 civilians crossed over from Sudan into South Sudan since the beginning of December. Many of those people are actually Sudanese, which is a change from the trends of arrival we have seen since April 2023, where 75% of the people coming into South Sudan were South Sudanese returnees. These 120,000 people and more still to come are coming on top of 800,000 persons who already sought safety in South Sudan since April 2023. Those people are fleeing the extreme violence that Ravina just described in Sudan and are extremely vulnerable, as well as the host community in South Sudan. We can see a number of alarming issues in Reng. And firstly, I would mention the high number of war wounded that have reached Reng country since late November, early December. Secondly, we can see a major strain on the resources of the local communities in Reng County, in particular on water and firewood, but also a huge pressure on basic services, including health, that are not geared up for such an amount of people. Thirdly, in addition, there is a cholera outbreak ongoing right now in South Sudan, with more than 20,000 cases already declared across the country and a very high fatality rate, linked to the poor access to water, safe water, and the status of the health services in the country. In regards to ICRC response, upon hearing about the high number of wounded that were requiring urgent surgeries, we deployed an ICRC mobile surgical team on the 8th of December and immediately started to operate on patients. Since the 8th of December, more than 260 surgeries were conducted by ICRC teams in Reng, and this is ongoing every day. With up to more than 100 surgical inpatients in the hospital at the same time, it's only because we team up with other actors, and in particular MSF, Médecins Sans Frontières, that we have been able to handle such a caseload. You have to remember that resources in Reng prior to the conflict in Sudan were only sufficing to serve a population of a few dozens of thousands of people. So the services are extremely stretched. And also we have to keep in mind that some of those services were actually provided in Sudan or from Sudan, such as advanced healthcare, access to electricity and many other services. Imagine how it looks like now in ranks that the population has more than tripled, possibly quadrupled in the last months. Imagine what Geneva would look like if its population would even double in less than 2 years. As mentioned, this is also more important that there is an outbreak of cholera in South Sudan and many other ongoing crises. Though in rank, this outbreak seems under control, we continue to register cases every day, and with the increased population, it could get worse. ICRC teams are supporting the South Sudan Red Cross Society as they conduct essential activity on the cholera response, including case management and provision of safe water. Today, along with Ravina, I stand in front of you to remind that the Sudan conflict is raging, affecting millions of people inside Sudan, but also millions of people in neighboring countries. 14 years after independence, South Sudan and Sudan remain highly interconnected economically and socially. The conflict in Sudan has a compounded effect with the impact of decades of ongoing intercommunal violence, conflict, and climate crisis in South Sudan. We need to be careful so that the spillover effect of almost 2 years of war in Sudan do not further aggravate the already deep humanitarian crisis in South Sudan, very far away from the cameras and the media interest. Thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you very much, Ravina and Florence, for this update on Sudan. Questions, Nina?
Yeah, thanks. I have two questions for Ravina. One is about Sudan. The other is about another issue.
Yeah, just ask for Sudan now because I've got some other questions and then we will go to...
Okay. So I just wanted to ask on Sudan, there have been reports of, or the U.S. is, reports from the U.S. saying that chemical weapons have been used by the army. I'm wondering if that's something that you have seen, and also the concerns around the fact that the sanctions imposed, the fresh sanctions imposed by the U.S. could result in further limiting of aid access. If you have any thoughts on that, thank you.
Thanks, Nina. Yes, of course, we've seen the report from the U.S. Now, our own office, within its limits of access, has not specifically documented the use of chemical weapons during this conflict in Sudan. Of course, these reports are very worrying, very concerning, and they do require further investigation. As you know, the use of chemical weapons is explicitly banned under international law. We will continue to gather available evidence. What we have documented is the use of extremely heavy weaponry in populated areas through the course of this conflict, including the use of airstrikes in heavily populated areas, in marketplaces. So this needs to stop, clearly. On the issue of sanctions, I mean, we're unaware of the precise factual basis that the U.S. has used to impose these sanctions. But it does reinforce the need for full investigation of the serious misconduct, the serious violations of IHL and international human rights law that we have documented on both sides, and for states to take steps that are available to them to bring the parties into compliance with their obligations. Obviously, we're also calling for compliance with the arms embargo that was imposed by the Security Council, and on all states that are providing military or other logistical assistance to parties to the conflict to continue to fuel this conflict for them to reassess the impact of their contributions.
Other question on Sudan in the room? I'll go to the platform. Lisa, I believe you have a question on Sudan. And Florence, Lisa Schlein is our Voice of America correspondent.
Actually, I have multiple questions, so if I'll try to be brief, but if you will please be patient with me. Thank you, Nina, for bringing up some of the questions so I can overdo that. As far as chemical attacks go, do you know, have that information where this is happening? Is it mainly in Darfur or is it also in other areas of Sudan? And who is it that there are, who are the countries that are providing the weapons? You talk about an embargo. Apparently, the embargo is not being respected. Do you think that specific sanctions from the United States and other countries against these countries would be useful, would be efficacious in making some kind of an impact on this? And then I would like to ask the UNHCR, or perhaps you have information on this, Ravina, as well, that is whether escape routes for Sudanese are being closed, whether it is difficult for the Sudanese to actually flee to other countries. Perhaps this is something that the Red Cross representative can also discuss, because there is a lot happening there. And then I noticed that there are some World Health Organization representatives, bless you for being there. Could you talk a bit about the situation of the Sudanese people, what you know about famine, the health situation, and whether aid is getting through to them? I'm almost finished. And specifically for the Red Cross representative, first, if you would send your notes, please. And then also, since there are so many South Sudanese returnees coming into the country, and also Sudanese nationals fleeing into South Sudan, is there a lot of hostility growing among the local communities where these people, where this huge influx is occurring? Because, as you mentioned, resources are very limited. And I am wondering whether the WHO is also helping you in terms of the cholera outbreak, which is occurring. And what is the role in the government in all of this? That is it able to provide any kind of security or any help to this situation? Thank you,
Lisa, for these multiple questions. So, yes, I'll give the floor to I've been joined on the podium by Eugene, who also has to brief on DRC, by the way, but she can also answer some of your questions. There are a few questions for Florence, and Tariq should still be online, so he can answer your questions on the WHO point of view. So let's start with Ravina.
Thank you, Lisa. You begged our patience, but in fact, I should thank you for bringing attention to this conflict, which is not in the headlines as much as it should be. It's an extremely dire situation. If you look at the figures, over 11 million people have been internally displaced, over 8.2 million of them by the ongoing conflict. 3.1 million fled to neighboring countries. Famine conditions in five areas. 25 million people face acute food insecurity. This is an extremely dire situation, which deserves all the attention it can get to try to engage, to try to put whatever pressure the international community can to bring this conflict to an end. On the use of chemical weapons, as I said to Nina, unfortunately, because we have such limited access, we don't always have all the information that we need on various very important aspects of this conflict. So within the limits of our access, we have not documented the use of chemical weapons during this conflict in Sudan. However, we have documented the use of extremely heavy weaponry, including explosive weapons used in populated areas, in a manner that raises serious concerns about compliance with international humanitarian law, the principles of precaution, and the prohibition on indiscriminate attacks. And this is why the High Commissioner has said that he is concerned that there is ongoing commission of war crimes and other atrocity crimes in Sudan. on the arms embargo, so there is a UN arms embargo that's applicable to Darfur. We are calling on all states to refrain from providing all types of military support in Sudan. This will, of course, have a decisive impact on ending the hostilities. And as you rightly point out, this embargo is not being fully respected. On sanctions, now, I believe you're aware of our position is that broad sectoral sanctions can be damaging to the human rights enjoyment of the population of a country. So we are generally against broad sectoral sanctions. Targeted sanctions can be effective in exerting pressure on specific individuals and organizations that are responsible for the perpetration of conflict. So we are calling on states to use whatever measures they can to use whatever leverage they have to pressure the parties to the conflict to bring this to an end. And this could also come in the way of the use of universal jurisdiction, for example, to bring to justice perpetrators of grave violations. I think that was all the questions for me, so I'll then...
Yeah, just to add to what Ravina said, Lisa, I think Ravina did well to point out the importance of speaking about this conflict, and I would just like, I mean, the numbers are absolutely incredibly, they're terrible. And I just wanted to add that the 2025 Humanitarian Needs and Response Plan coordinated by OCHA is seeking $4.2 billion to deliver life-saving aid to almost 21 million vulnerable people, restore basic services, and scale up protection. And to this amount, we have to add $1.8 billion to support 5 million people, primarily refugees, in seven neighboring countries. And maybe on this part, I'll give you the floor, Eugene.
Thank you, Nina, Lisa, for your question. We don't have any specific information of a blockage. If you heard any blockage, please let us know. For now, we haven't heard any blockage, but we really continue to call for safe passage for the people who would like to seek safety in neighboring country and seek asylum in neighboring country. And also we echoing what ICRC representative presented today, we are extremely concerned about the increased attacks at the border area and especially the border to Sudan and South Sudan. And then we are aware of those 120,000 plus people who arrived in rank and also find the dire situation in ranks. So we really call international community to step up their and scale their assistance to those who are returning to South Sudan. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Florence and Tariq?
Yes, thank you very much, Lisa, and thank you very much to all of you. I mean, as mentioned, the conflict in Sudan needs to require, but would need more attention from the international community. On the escape route, I think in the case of South Sudan, it's important to recall the history. South Sudan, as I mentioned, has been independent for less than 14 years. Sudanese and South Sudanese are one. Were one nation not that long ago. So there is, so far we've seen really a free passage from Sudan into South Sudan, whether for South Sudanese returnees, some of them who have never really lived in South Sudan for the returnees, or for Sudanese refugees. We also have to recall that the Comprehensive Peace Agreement allows actually Sudanese to settle in South Sudan and the same for South Sudanese in Sudan. So this has to continue to take place. We also have to recall that the crossing from Sudan into South Sudan doesn't only take place as official border crossing, but all around the line. This links into the question asked by Lisa about the relationship between the host communities and the returnees and refugees. I would say we have until yesterday, and I'll come back maybe on what's happening in the last 24 hours, we have seen no problems. Yes, the arrival of the Sudanese and of the South Sudanese returnees into South Sudan put a lot of pressure on communities. Many of the people are going to areas where there are no services. And when I say no services, there is no water, no electricity, no health services, no schools. but this is their area of origin, and they have been highly welcomed by those who were there, whether they were from those areas or IDPs from ongoing conflict in South Sudan or climate crisis in South Sudan. So that has been working well, but it also requires to work very closely with the communities when you work on assisting those who are arriving and ready to get on board the host communities and ensure they also, in a way, benefit from whatever support is brought to the community. Would it be only in alleviating the pressure of the new arrivals? Now, we also have to keep in mind that in the last 24 hours, things have changed a bit following the events in Wad Madani. I think that Ravina alluded to that. And we have seen scenes of violence, not only in Juba, but in Malakal, Wau Kwadjok, and other places with a new development, which is indeed attacks on Sudanese businesses at large. This is a concern. The authorities of South Sudan are taking that very seriously and trying to take measures to contain the violence and trying to protect the Sudanese in South Sudan. This is not a general trend. It's something that happens in reaction to what happened in Wad Madani two days ago against South Sudanese. There is a large majority of South Sudanese who are in support and see the Sudanese people as, in a way, their brothers and sisters. But this is a concern. So the authorities also, Lisa, to your question, in regards to the returns and arrivals of South of Sudanese refugees from Sudan, do try to bring their contribution to the response. But we also have to keep in mind that they are facing many challenges. It's a new country. There are a lot of challenges in terms of budget management. And also the budget of the government of South Sudan has been deeply amputated with the conflict in Sudan as the oil income have sharply reduced by at least 70% since the onset of the conflict in Sudan. So this puts a lot of limits. And we have to highlight that the humanitarian response is largely below what the needs are. And it's important to keep that in mind. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Florence. Before I give the floor to Tariq for the last part of the answer to Lisa, I would like to apologize. I leave you in the capable hands of Michele because I'm going to moderate the screening of the movie Cabrini, which is going to start very soon with a dialogue first and then the screening itself in room 19 if you want to join us afterwards. And Michele has everything, and we have not forgotten that in addition to the question on Sudan, there were people who had questions on human rights for Ravina. And then we still have Eugene, who has to brief you on the DRC, and Anktad, which has a who has an announcement. Thank you very much. I'll see you on Tuesday.
Thank you, Michele.
Yes, thank you very much. Good to see you. All here, I see two hands up online. Musa?
Oui, merci beaucoup. En fait, j'avais une question, deux questions, une sur le Soudan, puis une sur la Syrie. Mais la première sur le Soudan, je ne sais pas à qui la poser. En fait, on a l'impression que la situation sur le terrain s'empire de jour en jour. Mais au niveau politique, au niveau processus de paix, il n'y a rien qui se passe. Je voulais poser la question peut-être à Alexandra. Est-ce qu'il y a quelque chose au niveau des Nations Unies qui va bouger ou qui bouge afin de relancer un processus de paix? Mais je ne sais pas en fait à qui.
OK.
Ça va? Il y a un problème en technique.
Il y a un petit problème technique là. Écoutez... Je ne sais pas si Ravina ou mes autres collègues veulent adresser la question. Comme vous avez vu, j'arrive, c'était un peu imprévu que je passe, que j'arrive là. Peut-être, je préfère Moussa de vous répondre. Je vais peut-être vous écrire. J'arrive maintenant comme ça. C'est un peu soudain, donc au lieu de vous dire des banalités, là je préfère étudier un peu le dossier et voir, j'ai bien compris votre question, vous voulez voir si vous avez, s'il y a des nouvelles initiatives pour que le processus politique bouge au Soudan. Donc je reviendrai vers vous et vers le reste des journalistes dans la salle. Je vois que Tariq veut intervenir quand même, donc je vais lui donner la parole. Tariq.
Yes, thank you very much, Michele. There was a question on health situation, particularly, and a colleague from ICRC has already mentioned that. Let me just give a few figures from our side. Basically, what's happening is that access to the healthcare is really severely constrained. 39% of health facilities were reported as destroyed or non-functioning. Health facilities like medicines, medical supplies, and vaccination activities are very limited to the most in the most affected areas. Now, the situation in Khartoum is particularly stark. Around 90% of health facilities are not functional. MSF has suspended medical activities at Bashair Hospital, one of the last functioning hospitals in South Khartoum. And this is following the repeated attacks on staff and patients. Cholera, malaria, dengue, and measles have been reported in over 12 states. Over 50,000 cholera cases and 1,200 deaths have been reported. And now let me just give you some latest figures on attacks on healthcare. So since April 2023, there were 141 attacks, resulting in 240 deaths and 216 injuries. Since January 2024, that was 77 attacks, 202 deaths, and 171 injuries. So there are reports of cholera, measles, malaria, dengue, meningitis from several states. We have some figures, and I will share it in notes. But again, the access is difficult, and then the disease surveillance is also very difficult. So numbers are probably much higher. So the critical services, maternal child health, management of severe acute malnutrition, and the treatment of patients with chronic conditions have been discontinued in many areas. This also includes, unfortunately, the disruption in childhood vaccination, disease surveillance, and vector control. So really, this is like a vicious circle where there is less of health services for all people who need them, pregnant women, children, people who are injured in conflict. And unfortunately, many of areas are largely inaccessible to humanitarian actors because of insecurity and logistical challenges have basically restricted WHO's and partners' capacity to provide direct assistance to health facilities in Darfur, Khartoum, Al Jazeera, and other places in Sudan. I will send more numbers in notes. Over.
Thank you very much, Tariq. I think Ravina wanted to perhaps add something.
Thanks, Michele. No, just on Moussa, your question. Now, of course, on the exact progress in any peace negotiations, I would defer to my colleagues who are handling that side of things. But just to say that the reason why we felt in particular we had to speak out today is because of these reports of an imminent battle for Khartoum. We are worried about the kinds of violations that we may see as the parties to the conflict battle for control at all costs for Khartoum. And we are worried that this is taking us further away from peace and further into a horrific situation for civilians.
Thank you very much. Gabriela Sotomayor.
Thank you, Michele. Ravina, why there is no interest on what is happening in Sudan? Do you think there is racism or discrimination from donors or traditional media?
Gabriela, I would like to ask that question back to the press corps. We maybe this is more a conversation to have over coffee, but we do hear that there is not much interest in many major mainstream news media on Sudan, that even when reporters file stories, they're not featured prominently. I do not know the reasons behind this, but I hope that we will be able to work together to bring as much attention to this conflict as possible. A lot of the work we do behind the scenes is important, but the public pressure and the public advocacy is very important. And we hope that there will be more such advocacy and attention on the situation in Sudan.
Thank you very much. Moussa, vous avez toujours la main levée. Il y avait une autre question, mais je pense qu'il s'agit d'une question sur la Syrie. Donc, est-ce que... Nina, you have a question on Sudan?
No, I had another question that I said earlier.
Oh, I'm sorry, but my apologies. Yeah, thank you. So we've got two questions. Go ahead, Nina.
Yeah, thanks for Ravina. I wanted to ask about Russia and the verdicts against Navalny's lawyers and sentences to lengthy prison terms in Russia, if you have a reaction to that. Thank you.
Thanks, Lisa. I don't have a reaction on that specific case, so let me check with colleagues if they've been monitoring and if they can provide a specific reaction on that. But generally, as you know, we have been very concerned about the civic space restrictions in Russia, the targeting of dissent, the jailing, harassment, intimidation of anyone who dares to question the policies of the administration, and in particular people who speak out about the war against Ukraine. On the case on Navalny's lawyers, I'll get back to you if we have something more specific on that.
Thank you. Anna Dorlu, go ahead.
Thank you. Hello, Ravina. I want to ask about Gaza. As Palestinian side reported, since the ceasefire deal announced, Israel has killed over 100 Palestinians, including 31 women, 27 children. What is your office's report on that and how you evaluate those killings? Thank you.
Thank you. Yes, of course, we're following the situation closely. The ceasefire is meant to come into effect on Sunday. In the run-up to the ceasefire, we are seeing heavy bombardment, including last night. And we understand that the Ministry of Health in Gaza has reported that 81 Palestinians have been killed just on the 15th and the 16th of January. We are calling on all parties to the conflict to do everything they can to prevent the ceasefire deal from being derailed, to do everything they can to implement in good faith the ceasefire agreement, which has been so hard won, and to move towards finalizing phase two and phase three of this agreement as soon as possible.
Thank you. I still have hands up online from Gabriela. It is maybe you could say for you what the topic is and to whom your question is addressed.
Yes, thank you, Michele. It's for Ravina. President Biden announced that he would commute the sentences of nearly 3,000 inmates serving long prison terms for nonviolent drug offenses. So this is the broadest commutation of individual sentences ever issued by a U.S. president. So my question is, if you think that other countries, other governments, should follow that example, for example, Mexico. There is a lot of people in jail that it's only there because they were having some drugs or something in their pockets. Thank you.
The short answer, Gabriela, is yes. The office has been advocating for the decriminalization of drug use, and we have been advocating for alternative approaches to tackling the scourge of illegal drugs in society. So we would welcome this news. And unfortunately, what we are seeing in some countries, rather than looking for alternative ways and alternative punishments for possession of small amounts of drugs and drug possession, we are seeing the continued implementation of the death penalty
in relation to drug trafficking. And we, of course, are very much against that. The international human rights law prohibits the use of the death penalty in cases involving drug trafficking. So we would welcome this news, absolutely.
Yeah, thank you. Moussa, vous avez une autre question, n'est-ce pas?
Oui, merci beaucoup. Ma question pour Ravina. Bonjour Ravina. J'espère que M. Volker-Türk va nous briefer une fois de retour de la Syrie, après sa visite de la Syrie et au Liban. My question is, on the ground, there are many, many videos showing executions against pro-X regime or against Alawite minority. I don't know if you have some information about that and if you saw those videos. Thank you.
Thank you, Moussa. Yes, of course, we are aware of these reports and we have been seeing those videos, which are very worrying. As the High Commissioner said in his end of mission statement at the end of his short visit to Damascus, revenge and vengeance are never the answer. Instead, there needs to be a fully nationally owned healing, truth-telling and reconciliation process. Now, in his meeting with Ahmed Al-Shara, the High Commissioner did receive assurances of the importance of respect for human rights of all Syrians and of all components of Syrian society. The High Commissioner also stressed the need for this new Syria to not fall back into the old ways where the previous administration was using divide and rule tactics to keep the population under control. He has asked everyone to work together to ensure that a new Syria is built on inclusivity and the participation of people from all walks, from all segments of society, including women, men, people of different ethnic and religious backgrounds as well.
Yeah, thank you. Just to, perhaps if I can add to that, you know, it's important to remember from, the Secretary General's perspective that, you know, the situation in large parts of Syria has stabilized, but it's, the conflict is not over. And that in this context, the protection of civilians must be, the highest priority for the international community. I think that if there are no more questions for Ravina, particularly, at this moment, then we'll continue with the briefing and we'll move on to another topic that deserves attention and often doesn't get as much as it ought to, which is the Democratic Republic of the Congo. Eugene, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Michele. UNHCR, the UN Refugee Agency, is extremely alarmed by the worsening violence in the Eastern Democratic Republic of the Congo, which has already displaced 237,000 people this year. Escalating clashes between non-state armed group and the Congolese army in North and South Kivu provinces are intensifying what was already one of the worst, most alarming yet underreported humanitarian crisis, marked by widespread human rights violation and massive forced displacement. These two provinces are already home to 4.6 million internally displaced people, and the DRC is one of the world's largest hosts for people uprooted within their own borders. From 1st to 6th January, intense fighting in the Masisi and the Lubero territory of North Kivu province forced approximately 150,000 individuals to flee their homes just 1 week. Many initially sought safety in Masisi territory, northwest of Goma, the territory's main town, only to be displaced yet again as violence spread. Simultaneously, in South Kivu's Fizi territory, the local government indicated that 84,000 people are now displaced, causing them to request humanitarian assistance from the international community immediately. Civilians in both regions are enduring indiscriminate bombing and sexual violence. The use of heavy weaponry in populated areas has resulted in numerous civilian casualties, including children. The ongoing violence has left a displaced population in desperate need of shelter, food, clean water and medical care and has a severely limited humanitarian access in the short term. Many are fleeing, seeking refuge in overcrowded host community, makeshift shelter, and public buildings such as hospitals. Already dire humanitarian conditions are worsening rapidly, and access to this vulnerable population is severely restricted by insecurity, roadblocks, and presence of violent armed actors. Fighters are reportedly using civilian homes as a shelter, which is very concerning because it endangers residents by blurring the distinction between combatant and civilians. Despite the volatile security situation, approximately 25,000 displaced people return to Masisi Center following the temporary rule in violence on 4th of January. However, renewed clashes on 9th of January forced many to flee once again, which highlighting the fragility of situation and the town remain engulfed in uncertainty, which civilian facing ongoing violence, including forced recruitment and suspicion from armed actors. As soon as the humanitarian access permit, UNHCR is ready to help this population. UNHCR emphasized the urgency of addressing the escalating humanitarian crisis in DRC, and also safe and unimpeded access for aid workers must be guaranteed. And measures to protect the civilian, particularly women and children, must be prioritized. While UNHCR remain committed to supporting a displaced community in eastern DRC, the scale of the crisis demands immediate action to scale up relief efforts. Most importantly, UNHCR reminds all stakeholders that peace is a common good of our humanity, and it is a time that peace should prevail in the DRC, in the best interests of the region and also civilians. We urge increased investment in peace building and conflict resolution to address the root cause of forced displacement and build a foundation of lasting stability in the region.
Thank you very much, Eugene. Any questions for UNHCR or on the Democratic Republic of Congo? I do not see any. Perhaps if you don't mind staying around for a little longer in case the questions come up later on. Meanwhile, we'll go to Catherine from UNCTAD, who has an announcement to make.
Oui, bonjour à tous. Mon annonce est en français, mes notes seront en anglais. Ce matin, la secrétaire générale de la CNUSED, Rebecca Greenspan, a annoncé que la 16e conférence des Nations Unies sur le commerce et le développement, la CNUSED 16, se tiendra au Vietnam en octobre 2025, plutôt fin octobre, sur le thème « Façonner l'avenir ». Piloter la transformation économique pour un développement équitable, inclusif et durable. Je vous rappelle que les conférences ministérielles est le principal organe de gestion de l'organisation. C'est là où les nations membres de la CNUSED se réunissent pour discuter des tendances et des défis en cours en matière de commerce, de finance, d'investissement et de technologie au niveau mondial. La secrétaire générale a souligné ce matin l'importance historique de cette conférence. Le Vietnam n'est pas seulement un exemple de réussite en matière de développement, mais aussi un témoignage de la manière dont le commerce et le développement peuvent travailler ensemble pour transformer la vie des gens, dit-elle donc dans sa déclaration. Et d'ajouter, l'influence économique croissante de l'Asie, ses réalisations en matière d'intégration régionale et son leadership diplomatique grandissant font du Vietnam le cadre idéal pour réimaginer l'avenir du commerce mondial et du développement. On attendra à cette conférence des chefs d'État, des ministres du commerce, de l'économie, des finances, du développement des 195 États membres de la CNUSED, qui, je vous le rappelle, sont aussi les membres de l'ONU, des chefs d'organisations internationales, d'éminents économistes, dont des prix Nobel, des organisations de premier plan de la société civile, des banques de développement, des organisations financières et commerciales globales, qui seront donc les acteurs de cette conférence et des débats qui seront menés et des décisions qui seront prises à ce moment-là pour redéfinir le mandat de la CNUSED pour les 4 années qui suivront. Les détails concernant le lieu précis, l'inscription des journalistes et la participation à cet événement important seront communiqués dans les semaines à venir. C'est la première conférence quadriennale qui aura lieu sous l'égide et sous la direction de Rebecca Greenspan. Voilà, et des États membres, bien sûr. Merci.
Merci, Catherine. Oui, tu as une question pour Catherine? Ah non, d'accord, ok, pour Eugene, d'accord.
Sorry, Eugene, thank you. I just wanted to clarify. So when you say that the displacement has been this year, so it's since the 1st of January, just to, okay, thank you.
Thank you very much. If there are no questions... Ah oui, tu as une autre...
J'ai juste oublié de vous dire qu'un communiqué de presse va partir dans les minutes qui suivent et avec un lien sur le discours de la secrétaire générale de la CNUSED. Pardon, merci.
Merci beaucoup, Catherine. Moi aussi, j'ai des annonces. I will read these in English. As announced to you yesterday, the Conference on Disarmament, which is the world's single multilateral disarmament negotiating forum, will hold its first public plenary of its 2025 session on Tuesday, the 21st of January. The meeting will start at 10 a.m. under the presidency of Italy. Tatiana Valovaya, Director General of the United Nations Office at Geneva and Secretary General of the Conference on Disarmament, will address the conference at a later date. Public meetings, which will be held in the Tempest Building of the Palais des Nations, can be followed in person or through the Listen Live page, which is listen-live.un.ch. The 2025 session of the Conference on Disarmament will be divided up into three successive parts from the 20th of January to the 28th of March, from the 12th of May to the 27th of June, and from the 28th of July through 12 September. The presidency of the conference rotates among its member states according to the English alphabetical order, which each president holding office for 4 working weeks. After Italy's presidency until the 14th of February, the following countries will also take the presidency during 2025. Japan until the 14th of March, Kazakhstan in a period between the 17th and the 28th of March and between the 12th and the 23rd of May, Kenya from 26th of May to the 20th of June, Malaysia, and then Mexico. The high-level segments of the conference will be held from the 24th to the 28th of February in room 19 at the Palais des Nations. I also have a meetings update on the Committee on the Rights of the Child. It's meeting for its 98th session from the 13th to the 31st of January at Pelly Wilson. And it's concluding this afternoon the review of the report of St. Kitts and Nevis, which began yesterday. Thank you. I don't have any further announcements. I know I have to get back to you on a question from Musa, and if there are no further questions, I think we'll wrap up the briefing here. Thank you very much.